Welcome to the Surratt Brothers Podcast, a conversation about church, sports, current events, and mostly church. Today we talk about how I ruined Greg and Chris's lives, our top three leadership books, and we reminisce about our Pentecostal roots with our friend George Wood. Now join me and my brothers for the podcast. Welcome to the podcast. Glad you're here with us. We have a full room of Surratt Brothers today. Greg, hey. As we're recording this past Sunday, University of South Carolina wins it all. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. Did you see that the championship game was higher ratings than the men's championship game?
I saw that.
I cared more about that. Yeah.
Jeff, great. Why did you go automatically to Greg on this? My daughter is an alumni of South Carolina. We are proud.
That's awesome.
Gamecocks in our house, although none of us ended up watching that game. I was in church because it was in Hawaii time, and my daughter doesn't even know that basketball exists, but we are proud Gamecocks.
That might have been why I went there first. Greg, did you watch the game?
Watch the whole game.
Yeah,
that was great. I was conflicted. I was conflicted because obviously South Carolina, and I followed him or them, and they were undefeated and amazing team, amazing coach. But Iowa was, you know, Caitlin Clark. We talked about that a few weeks ago, but she is just amazing. It was hard to pull against her.
Yeah, no, I felt the same way. It was a great game, fun to watch. I was glad that Iowa made a game out of it at the end. But those South Carolina girls, Greg, you had shared. I was going to try to share it on the podcast, but I'm not going to because I'm not technically that smart. But the South Carolina coach, her post-game interview put to organ music, that was a winner.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
you have you've got to see that on Instagram. Maybe you can put it in the show notes, the link, but yeah. That is amazing. She was praising Jesus to a church background of a church organ. It was awesome.
So good. So Chris, you are back from Hawaii. You're home with the chickens. How's everything? You settling back into the United States of America? How's it going?
Well, your first mistake is Hawaii is actually a part of the United States of America.
No. So are you serious?
I didn't know that.
50th state. 50th
state. What language do they speak over there? Speak English?
So I am back on the mainland, as they would say.
Mainland.
And yes, it's good. It's a little weird stepping out of your life for 6 months and then kind of stepping back into it. And then as we got back, right before we got back, there was a big storm here in Nashville, which is not unusual. But the storm decided to pick up a pergola, large pergola that I had in my back porch and drop it onto our house, our cars, and our mower. And pretty much wrecked everything. So that was fun. It was a good welcome home when we
was there any moments seriously when you thought, I'm just going to stay in Hawaii?
When we found out, our daughter Brianna called and said, you know, your pergola is gone and my car is pretty much gone because of it. There was a moment we may have thought, you know, let's just not go home. Let's just stay here. But now it's very nice to be back in my house and my bed and know where all the tools are and all of that. But a little bit of a rocky landing, but we'll be okay.
Yeah. Well, glad you're back. I'm back from last week. I mentioned on our last show, I was going to Vegas, back from Vegas. Put it all on red, which explains why I'm back working again. No, we didn't at all. You know what I did see? I saw two really cool shows. We saw Penn and Teller, which was fun magic. We saw the Cirque Soleil Michael Jackson show, which Chris, you had mentioned you've seen that. So yep. Good. I had a takeaway from it, and this is kind of semi-serious. Like, the special effects are unbelievable, and they have performers, acrobats flying in from all over the auditorium, and what looks like a hologram. I don't think it was, but it looks like it, of Michael Jackson toward the end of the show. And I told Sherry afterwards, I said, you know, a lot of church leaders see something like this and they go, oh, we got to do this at our church. Like, we've got to have the flying monkeys and the, all the stuff. And yeah, that's fine. I'm not against it. But I told Sherry, I said, I don't need that. Like, Cirque Soleil is here. I can go see it anytime I want to. Pay the money, go see it. It's not a bad thing to have production in a church. Absolutely not. I just think church pastors probably could relax a little bit and go, hey, I don't have to be Cirque Soleil because they are Cirque Soleil. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then we went to Zion National Park, which was really cool.
What hikes did you do at Zion?
Here's the deal. We don't hike, but we rode the shuttle, and we spent more time waiting in line for the shuttle than we did in Zion doing hikes. So we hiked to the start of the Narrows, and then we looked at the people getting in the river, and we said, have fun, and then we turned around and went back.
That's too bad. The Narrows, we did that the first time we hiked to the beginning of it, because it's a short little hike up to where the river starts. But the Narrows is just an amazing, amazing adventure. You're just walking through cliffs, through water. But that sounds like you had a good time, though.
Oh, we did. It's amazing. So today, did you guys know this? When we're recording today, this is National Siblings Day. Greg, did you realize this is National Siblings Day?
I didn't know there was a National Siblings Day. That's awesome.
Yeah. Did you know you have siblings?
Yep. What's that?
Did you know you had siblings? Just checking on that. Yeah. So today is National Siblings Day.
Make them name all of them. Can you name?
How many siblings do you have, Greg? How many siblings do you have?
You know, that's a tough question. People ask me that. And I remember my childhood, and there were three of us.
Yeah.
There are indeed four of us. Just one of them wasn't around most of the time that I remember growing up. So, yeah, that's a confusing question.
Chris said, name them. I'm not going to go. That'll take us a while. So we're not going to go down that path. Here, though, the reason I know it's National Siblings Day, I saw a headline that said NPR is doing a whole series of articles on how our siblings shape us. And so I thought it'd be fun for a minute for you guys to just talk about how I shaped you, like being my brother. How did that impact your, maybe we should broaden it a little bit. Like how did we shape each other? How did we impact each other? Is there have we influenced each other?
Do you remember the time when our grandmother was babysitting us? This is before Chris. And, you got mad and threw our puppy against the wall and broke its arm or leg or whatever.
Thanks for bringing it up. I may remember the story a little different where the dog bit me and I dropped it, but I remember the incident. How is that apropos?
Well, it shaped me in that I've had to have trauma counseling as a result of that one night of that poor dog, nursing that dog all night long until we get to the doctor the next day. That was very shaping.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Chris, can you want to bring up as well? Yeah,
I'll continue the theme of how Jeff shaped me.
We don't need to hear about the phone.
When he decided to get angry at me, yanked a telephone. This is back when they had telephones in the house, and yanked it out of the wall. It was a working telephone, from what I understand. Yeah. And threw it across the room and caught me right above my eye, which I still have a scar. Now, I will say that's the only thing I remember or only thing I know about it is I have a scar. I don't remember the actual throwing of the phone, but I'm sure it shaped, you know, some trauma in my life as well. So again, thanks, Jeff.
It literally marked me.
Yeah. And it's violence. I think we're on a theme here with Jeff.
Again, a great story.
Yeah.
Grounded in very little truth, but a great story. It is a great story. So keep telling it. I would keep telling it.
I'll show you the scar. I don't know what isn't true about a scar, but I'll show it to you if you want.
Are you saying that it didn't happen? That didn't happen?
I'm saying it's gotten better through the years. Speaking of scars, like maybe we could get our sister on to show some of the scars she has from some incidents of her brother throwing a dart and sticking it in her heel. Like that might've, that might've shaped her.
You know, I have a deviated septum partially as a result of her kicking me in the nose one time.
Is that right?
And
is
so, that right? Yeah.
Well, you had a tough life, Greg. That is really rough. So that it's all because of your siblings.
I feel like that.
I was actually thinking about this because you did send this ahead of time. And all seriousness, I was thinking about how everything is competitive in my life. Like I always have to win no matter what it is. It's just something. And I think that was shaped by having siblings, that even though I was much younger, you guys would never let me win and push me around a little bit. And I mean, just having brothers, you're going to be competitive. And I think that's a good thing and a bad thing in life. But I think that has definitely shaped the way I approach a lot of things.
Yeah, we definitely grew up with the you don't let somebody else win. Like, Greg, I'm six years younger than you are. We'd play games, play basketball, whatever. There was no letting. I don't know that I ever beat you or anything, but there was no letting me win. And Chris, you got the same treatment from me. And being 10 years younger, I probably should have let you win once in a while. But yeah,
I never let my girls beat me in anything. Never.
Yeah. No, I love. I never let my kids beat me in anything. So I have with the grandkids, I do occasionally let them win. But hey,
soft.
Born, so
soft.
Yeah, I got it. Speaking of soft. Headline of the week. So we always do a headline each week. Headline of the week. So the majority, I think it's 54%, a majority of Gen Zers who were surveyed said that filling out their taxes brought them to tears, and that one in four of Gen Z, which is what, teenager, early 20s, said that after filling out their taxes, they'll need help from their therapist to recover from the experience. So question. Does filling out taxes bring you to tears?
No, but the reason is I married an accountant and we married at 20. And so from year one of actually having to file, I think she has filed. So no.
So you've never filed.
The idea of filling out taxes makes me want to cry. Yeah. And, you know, that whole deal, but I don't think I've ever, you know, I take mine to an accountant. I used to fill them out though.
Yeah. Well, I do my own. In fact, I got to do them Saturday because it's in our DNA that you can't, if it's due on Saturday, why would you do it before Saturday? And so I'm doing it on Saturday. There will not be tears, but as both of you very, very gently and kindly reminded me, I occasionally have anger problems. And so there may be some bowling words expressed on Saturday while filling out the taxes, but no tears. So what's your advice? Gen Zers, are they crying? They've got to go to their therapist because they have to fill out their taxes. What would be your advice to Gen Zers on how to deal with those emotions?
Well, I parent two Gen Zers and both of them are now filing taxes. And the oldest one's a little bit better than the youngest one, but the youngest one called her mom, I think just a month ago, crying, thinking about having to do her taxes. So I think this is a true thing. And luckily in our family, her mom is an accountant, as I mentioned earlier. So she was able to walk her through it. But I don't really have any advice other than marry an accountant.
Yeah.
You know, why doesn't the government figure this out and make it easier? I mean, you know, the whole Gen Z thing and crying and all that, that's kind of funny. But it's it really is a traumatic experience if you have to fill out your own taxes. That's why I go to an accountant, because I never got them done on time and it was a mess. And I just figured whatever money that they could possibly find a way to get money to get back, I'd pay somebody else to do them. But I wish the government would figure out an easier way to do that.
That's a great point. Every time I do my taxes, I always think, so you have to put in your income, right? So your income comes off of forms that the government has copies of. So W-2s, 1099s, right? They have a copy of all of that. So it's kind of like they're saying, we know how much you made, but we want to find out if you'll tell us what you made and be honest about it. They also know how much money I gave to charitable organizations. They know how much I spent on, they know all they, the government has all those figures. Why do, are they asking me? I'm with you, Greg. Like, let's, there's got to be a way. I'm all for government needs money to run roads, police, all that stuff. Just take it and leave me alone. Like, that's, of course, that's my, I would like that in all of my finances. Just somebody just, you have my money, just give me what I need and I'll be fine. Hey, so we were talking about Gen Z and it's a good point. I mean, it is stressful. And it gets more and more stressful, but Gen Z is young leaders, in their 20s. Greg, you have a lot of younger leaders come through, the retreat. And before we get to this question, I want to circle back quickly to the retreat. So I'm on your email list. I don't know, Chris, if you are or not, but I got your email this past week about, some zoning things going on with the retreat. Give it real quick, Greg, just kind of give us a update on what's going on with that zoning thing. And
well, you know, we've been going 3 years and over 1700 leaders have come through. I've had 4 retreats in 7 days this week, so it's kind of crazy, but that's a lot of wear and tear on the facility and all of that. But we've been in a long process with zoning here in Charleston. The zoning's always interesting, and they've been actually, it's slower than what I want, but they've been good. I mean, they allow us to operate and all this, but they decided a few months ago that we are now a commercial entity. In other words, the building has to be up to commercial standards. So all of a sudden we're looking at $750,000 of renovations that will be helpful. They really will be good, but we just weren't planning on it. And so we're going to shut down June, July, August, and God willing, we are going to renovate and bring it up to, commercial standards.
Yeah. I saw it's, I mean, some of it's huge with the septic system and the commercial kitchen, and there's just, and having been there, I think I've been there 4 times now or something like that. Like, it operates really well as it is, but you're right. These improvements are going to take it to another level. But yeah. I just wanted to mention that. We'll put in the show notes. Sorry. We'll put in the show notes a link to the website. Honestly, you didn't ask for this, Greg, but I can't think of a better thing like to contribute to help you guys through this time. Do that, get that $750,000, get it up to speed, because I don't know if all of our listeners know, but the men and women who come to the retreat, they don't pay a dime. And so it's not based on your financial ability to pay. Most of them are in mid-sized, normal sized churches. And it's just life-giving. So yeah, I just wanted to circle back on that.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rooted Network and the Rooted Discipleship Experience. I'm happy to tell you about Rooted because we're actually launching Rooted in my church this fall, and I'm excited about it because it's an intentional plan for starting new groups and building a discipleship culture in a local church. Thousands of churches around the country have learned that what makes the Rooted experience uniquely powerful is that it's built on the 7 rhythms of a disciple, and it includes intentional, experiential learning opportunities. That means Rooted helps you ground your people in the foundational spiritual disciplines, but they won't just study them. There are planned learning opportunities each time you do Rooted, like prayer experiences, serve experiences, and more, that help the Bible move from knowledge to action. It's a powerful, repeatable way to see life change in the people in your church. A lot of churches have benefited from this discipleship plan, so we encourage you to check it out at experiencerooted.com. There you can download a free sample of the Bible study or register for a free webinar to learn more. Again, that is experiencerooted.com.
Segueing into young leaders, I wrote an article this past week. I was just thinking about some of the leadership books that have gone into my development as a leader. And as I'm around younger leaders, great ideas, and I hear who they're listening to, the podcast they're listening to, and the preachers that they follow. And I think all of that's great. But sometimes I wonder if they really have a foundation of leadership. And I was saying I have the best foundation, but all 3 of us, probably between us, have read 200-300 books on leadership. Like, it's something we read and continue to read. So I was wondering, what are your top three must-read leadership books? Like, if you sat down with a young pastor, a guy just getting started in ministry, what are three books you'd say, hey, dude, you got to read these three? I'll go first. Mine may be on your list, may not. My first one is an oldie, but essential, just Developing the Leader Within, John Maxwell. And Greg, I know you know John well. Most of leadership stuff that I read honestly goes back to that book, not just from John's other stuff, but other people's stuff. So I think every leader should read that one. One, a friend of ours wrote a few years ago, Empowering Leadership by Michael Fletcher. To me, that's the best book on church leadership, leading in the church. And then my third one's a little bit different. It's by Chip and Dan Heath called Switch, and it is phenomenal on how to lead through change. So those are my three. Chris, I sent this, you saw this maybe a little in advance, so maybe you've had a chance to think about it. What are your three?
Yeah. My three would be, Spiritual Leadership by the Blackabees. That's a pastoral Bible for me. I actually coach some guys through it a lot. So I definitely would go with that. Oswald Sanders version, his is the original Spiritual Leadership, is also great. A newer one for me is Lead by Paul David Tripp. Really, really good book. Also recommend that to any potential pastors. And then my third one is also a little bit different. The First 90 Days. It's a business book, but I can't imagine a better book to start a new role with, especially as a pastor. And I would put number four would be Empowering Leadership too. But yeah, those are my top three.
Yeah, I go back to The First 90 Days. Sherry and I do. Anytime we change jobs, we always pull it back out, read through the first few chapters to remind us of, if you're going into a new situation, I think that's essential. Greg, how about you?
Yeah, you know, the Maxwell book is, I kid John that he's written it several times and put different titles on it, but it captures essence of leadership. And so that's one that I keep fairly handy, and I really do like it. One of them that's influenced me a lot is The Leadership Pipeline. And I know when you guys were here at Seacoast, we looked at that a lot, and it's more about organizational leadership, you know, and how to build a pipeline. But the very first part of it is leading yourself. And, I've done a lot of thinking, about that. One that I just think is really, really good today. It's been very helpful for me over the last year. In fact, I'd say it's one of the best books I've read over the last year is The Working Genius. I don't know what he titles it. Lencioni's latest book. But that, everybody should read that, especially if you're working on any kind of a team. It's a fascinating look at how you work together.
Yeah. When you mention leadership pipeline, that is a phrase that's everywhere now. Like, you hear it all the time. But Greg, you and I remember the first time we heard about that book. We were at a Leadership Network event, and one of the authors was there. We had never heard of it before. We went home and devoured it. And I think it would be great for anyone in leadership development. Go back and read that. That's where it all kind of came from, and you hear the basics of that. And I agree with you too, that the Working Genius is just a paradigm that I really, really love. Hey, we're going to talk in just a minute. We're going to talk to George P. Wood, who is with the Assemblies of God. We all grew up in the Assemblies of God. I don't think any of us are now officially allowed back into the Assemblies of God, or for various reasons, most of them good. But we all grew up, like, our grandpa was AG and our dad and our uncles and cousins, and all of us at one time or another were actually credentialed in the Assemblies of God. And as you think back on that, what is there anything that you think back on your growing up that growing up it seemed normal, but now you look back and you're like, you know what, that might have been a little bit odd. So one of the ones that hit me is I grew up in Bible quiz. You guys know what Bible quiz is. Listeners may not. It's a quiz thing where you got two churches against each other, three teenagers from each church. They ask questions about the Bible, and you try to hit a buzzer, and the first one gets to answer the question. That is how I spent almost all of my Saturdays, from the time I was about 14 to the time I was about 17, memorizing parts of the Bible and then being quizzed on it. That's how I met my future wife, Sherry, and it seemed normal. And when I got out of high school and college and started telling people that, I realized, oh, that's not normal. That's not what other teenagers were doing. They were doing other things other than answering questions about the Bible all day, every Saturday. So how about you guys? Is there anything you think back on your past in the AG? You go, you know, that probably was a little different.
I would say even the language that we spoke, and I'm not talking about speaking in tongues, but you had a whole, you know, outside of church, you called each other by your name. Inside of church, it was brother, you know, butler, remember him, or sister so-and-so, which there's some value to that, you know, as being a family, but it didn't seem strange at the time. But as I grew up a little bit, kind of got away from it, I thought that really is kind of unique.
I was just talking about the other day. I remember our dad at general councils, he would see, you know, other pastor friends of his, and they would call each other doctor. It was always, and I knew none of them had a doctorate. It was doc. Yeah. It was doctor, doc. And it just seemed normal at the time. But then now it's like none of them had a doctorate. So I don't know why they called themselves that. But for me, Royal Rangers was at the time like a normal deal. But looking back, there were some weird things. And it was like the AG has to have a Cub Scout version or a Boy Scout version that is kind of the same, but not really the same. And I remember getting sent home from a Royal Ranger camp thing that we did because a friend of mine and we went around and knocked out all the tent poles of all the tents around us and just collapsed them on everybody in the middle of the night. And I got sent home for that. But looking back, Royal Ranger's just a little bit odd.
Greg, do you remember where we were?
You were born. Yes. Yes. Yeah. When Chris was born, we were at a Royal Ranger. Was it called a Jamboree?
I think it was a national powwow.
I don't remember. Powwow. That was it. Powwow. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And we left. We went out of shower in like 3 days. We left straight from the powwow and drove to the hospital.
Met
our new little brother. Well, yep. We're going to talk to George Wood, and this is George P. Wood, and we'll talk about it with him in a few minutes. There's a big difference between George O. Wood and George P. Wood, but George P. Wood is the executive editor of Assemblies of God Publications, coordinator of religious freedom initiatives for the Assemblies of God. But more importantly than that, he used to work for our cousin Doyle. So we'll quiz him a lot about that. So let's talk to George. So we're joined today, as I said, by a longtime Surratt family friend, George Wood. George, you actually are more connected to the dark side of the Surratt clan. Is that right? Like there could be a whole other podcast called Surratt Brothers that you probably are more connected to, Doyle and some of those guys.
I don't think of them as the dark side of the Surratt family. I consider them the West Coast operation of the Surratt Mafia, is the way I think of it. But I'm connected to the other. I'm connected to the other trio of brothers. So,
right. Well, we could call them West Coast, but one of them lives in Peoria, Illinois. So unless there's been a horrible thing happen, I think he's more in the center. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. It means a lot. I really appreciated it. So George, as I mentioned, your role now with the Assemblies of God is you're actually executive editor of Assemblies of God Publications. So it's not just Influence Magazine, right? It's a wider scope at this point.
It's basically Assemblies of God Magazine, our Influence Magazine, but it's also our minister's newsletter. Basically any magazine that goes to all ministers, I edit. So that's, we have those two publications and then just whatever duties are assigned as well.
Okay. Hey, the trivia question. So all three, we talked a little bit earlier, but all three of us brothers grew up in the Assemblies of God, as I know you did too. And we miss the Pentecostal evangel. What happened to the Pentecostal evangel? Like, is it still out there, or what is the final resting place?
The Pentecostal Evangel was closed down by my father actually, because of declining circulation. And so we now have an online news channel, news.ag.org. But yeah, the Pentecostal Evangel was, you know, the official magazine, weekly magazine of the Assemblies of God. And it actually preceded the Assemblies of God and was, you know, instrumental in calling the first general council.
I don't think you can't have the Assemblies of God without the Pentecostal Evangel. I mean, it just can't exist.
Well, it's done so for like 8 or 9 years now. So
obviously all three of us in one way or another have been asked to not be in the Assemblies of God anymore. So we are not up on the latest, but having said that, George,
Three of us, I think I'm the only one that actually was asked to return the credentials. They called me and said, we no longer want you to have them. So I think I'm the only one that did that.
Actually,
which district were you part of?
That was the district of South Texas.
Yeah, I was kicked out of the I was asked to return mine from the district of South Carolina, mostly because I went to work for you, Greg, as a rebel in the world.
They never asked me turn mine in. No.
Okay. Hey, well, only one. Be that as it may, we also all, and it is total serious, we love the Assemblies of God. We talked a little bit about our heritage before. Our grandfather was a pastor in the AG, our dad, our uncles, you know, and so we have deep roots there. Let me ask you something, George, on that, on the Assemblies of God. Then I want to get a little more personal. So you've been, how long have you worked there in Springfield at headquarters?
This will be at the end of the year, my 15th year. So it's the longest job that I've ever held, other than working with Doyle. That would be the second longest job that I've ever held. But yeah, I started.
As I understand it. Yeah. So
you understand.
I was going to say working with Doyle was the second longest job. Was that because literally it was, or it just felt like it was? Like I could see, I could see that feeling like 20 years, even though you've only been there 6 months.
He should get a medal for working with. Yeah. Doyle for any period of time, I would think.
So
it was a little bit of both. It was almost 10 years and two different stints, and there were definitely some moments that it felt longer. So
right. Well, we would apologize, but we know our cousin doesn't listen to us, so that's absolutely fine. George, I wanted to come from like a 30,000-foot level. So it's always interesting when I see growth charts for denominations or networks of Christian churches globally and in America. And if you look at all of the, every mainline denomination, wherever you want to put the Southern Baptist mainline or not, all the lines are down, except that there's one little line that's always going way up, and it's always the Assemblies of God, like always bucking the trend of growth. Like it is, I don't even know what negative growth means, but the Assemblies of God is always on that positive line. What would you say, just you've been in it all your life, you have been at headquarters for 15 years. Could you give us one or two things that you would say probably leads to that growth when other networks, for the most part, are all struggling reaching new people?
I'd probably say two things, and I don't know, well, three things. I don't know, you know, the order of priority. I think that the fact that, you know, we are a spirit-filled denomination, I think that catches a wave of growth that just isn't, you know, available if you're Baptist or Presbyterian or Methodist or whatnot. I think one of the most noticeable things about Assemblies of God growth is ethnic diversity. Last time I checked the statistics, it was like 56% white and 44% ethnic minority. And the most growing parts of the AG are typically Hispanic or one of our other ethnic minority groups. And then the third thing is that the AG, and this is something that people who are outside the AG sometimes don't appreciate is that we have a fairly, we have a strict rule on terms of beliefs, for example, right? Like, you know, you've got to believe that tongues is the initial physical evidence of baptism of the Spirit. And I know that that's one thing that set it apart from ARC churches, which, you know, are open to charismatics, but they don't, you know, that's not a thing that's required. But other than, I think, a fairly basic doctrinal system, it's basic organizational commitments, you really can do what you want to in the Assemblies of God. And so there's a high degree of entrepreneurial activity because there's not a high degree of structure that you know, we don't have bishops. Essentially every local church is, you know, at least on paper, is autonomous. And we like that. We even now have like merch that says voluntary cooperative fellowship on it. I don't know who came up with that, but you know, we sell like jackets that say voluntary cooperative fellowship. And, I think that those three things go toward explaining growth. I mean, it's just, you know, kind of keep it basic, be powered by the Spirit to go evangelize the world. And then, don't create cultural barriers to people coming into your fellowship, and don't become so highly regimented that you can't have a lot of entrepreneurial activity. But even so, we are growing. The statistics that I see show continued growth, but I don't think it's every year it's even matches, like, for instance, replacement growth. So I look at growth in terms of the birth rate. Are we beating the birth rate? And we're not necessarily beating the birth rate. And so while we're not on a precipitous climb, like, let's say, the Southern Baptist Church, which lost, I think, 1,200 churches last year, which would be 10% of all of our churches. It's a smaller number for them. I think that there's some things going for us. But it's still a struggle. You still have to aggressively plant churches because churches are always closing down.
Yeah. Yeah. I just always think it's fascinating. I love what you said too about the diversity. Like, all of us, our listeners might not all know where the Assemblies of God came from, but if you go back to Azusa Street, you go back to what happened in Kansas, it was a very diverse crowd. It was people from all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of ethnicities. And to see that continue in the Assemblies of God and see the growth, especially among Hispanic churches and things like that, is super healthy to me. George, you mentioned a while ago your dad. And anyone who knows the Assemblies of God knows your dad's name, George Wood. And he led the Assemblies of God for a long time, both nationally and then in Southern California, and just in a lot of different ways. What are the challenges of working in an organization where your dad was such an icon? And I get confused with my brother Greg a lot. Usually it's the police or, you know, somebody like that wanting that he owes money to. But I imagine that people from the outside confuse you sometimes, even with your dad. What are the challenges of working in an organization where your dad was such an icon?
Well, people rarely confuse me with my dad just because we don't look alike. I look more like my mom than my dad. Although I will say that I was a philosophy graduate at Wheaton College, and I met Doyle while I was at Wheaton because he was the pastor of a church nearby. And so I joined their college group. But for years, the guys in the philosophy department thought that I had become the general superintendent of the Assemblies of God. And they were really impressed because they said, he's so young. And I'm like, have you ever seen the George Wood who leads the Assemblies of God? It's rare that I get confused, although I will say that one year, I think it was 2009 when Dad was up for election, I got like 120 votes for general superintendent in the nominating ballot. And Dad said after that, you need to put your full middle name onto the ministerial directory because you're taking my vote. So One of the interesting things about working for the Assemblies of God that came up initially when I became executive editor was cries of nepotism, right? And And it was interesting because I actually got hired by another guy that I worked for in Southern California and reported to him. But because Dad was at the top of the organization, it looked nepotistic. And I remember one minister who made this complaint had written to my dad and said, "You need to fire your son immediately. This is nepotistic." So I went and looked on his website, and he was from, I think, South Texas, actually. And his whole family was employed by the church. And I'm like, wow, you know. So I think that that's an initial problem. I'm still here 14 years later. So I think now I've kind of earned my spot. That was an initial problem. The interesting thing about Dad, though, is that Dad would figure out where to put people regardless of, you know, their relationships or connections. But what he was looking for was for competent people. And when I started on this job, I was still fairly young. I was just turned like 40. And people didn't realize this, but I had been through all types of churches, a church plant where we had 10 people that grew, that moved into temporary facilities, that merged with a large church. I worked at two mega churches. I was a pastor of a small turnaround church in Santa Barbara. He was just looking. They were looking, when they were looking for the executive editor, for somebody with a wide variety of experiences. And I probably was the only male who applied who had started and led a women's Bible study as a single man. That was fascinating, by the way. But, you know, Dad always created room for my sister and me to do whatever we felt, you know, God wanted us to do. And so I never felt uncomfortable working with him. I probably was the only person in the Assemblies of God who could walk into his office, open up one of his desk drawers and borrow a pen. But, you know, I mean, that's the way it was. But the flip side is that I never reported to Dad. I reported to other people. And so it wasn't like I was working for him. He was the guy down on the third floor that would take me to lunch every week, you know.
So
your dad, yeah, to me was just an incredible, incredible guy. He would reach out to me in Seacoast Church for a variety of reasons. Was started as a non-denominational church, even though, as Jeff mentioned earlier, the three of us bleed AG blood. We're third generation. And your dad never treated me like an outsider, much the opposite. He was always pursuing relationship. And I loved the man. Just thought he was a great leader, respected him intensely, and have fond memories of your dad.
Yeah, your dad, the legacy is unbelievable. Like I didn't get to meet him. My wife did when she was CEO of MOPS, and she just walked away going, what a leader full of integrity and kindness and all of that. One of the things you said, George, made me wonder, are you sure you're not a Surratt? Cause you said as a single man, you started and led a women's Bible study. Like that sounds something like a Surratt would go, yeah, I could do that. Like, I think we may be related somewhere. I just think,
well,
so.
Doyle and Connie didn't give me a choice. I mean, they basically said, look, these ladies, and they're all married ladies with kids. And they said, you know, they want to start a Bible study and you're the only one who can do that. So you get to do that. I'm like, okay. Look, yeah, so funny. You all know Doyle. He's your, I don't know. Is he the oldest of the cousins or?
He is one of the, I mean,
yeah. Okay. Well, so when we were in Seal Beach at the little church, which was at 9th and Electric, in Seal Beach, great corner, wonderful little traditional church building. The homeless people would use the alleyway between the church and the next building as a place to sleep, shower, and, you know, use the toilet. And so back in the early 90s, when we were still wearing suits, even at what was starting to become a contemporary church plant, I mean, if you go back 34 years and remember what that was like, one day Doyle walked through the alley and he said, "Hey, George, one of the homeless guys, you know, took a dump out there. You need to go clean it up." So I'm in a suit and I'm like, didn't even dawn on me to, you know, say that's not in my job description. I'm like, "Oh, yes, sir." And so I went out there and did that. And that's kind of how my relationship with Doyle and Connie was. It was like, "Hey, we need you to do this." Okay. It's not a problem. But we'd argue a lot too. But I mean, you know, if they said we need you to do something, I'd go do it.
Well, we know them as being fairly abusive, so we understand. Yeah. You know, that whole
Well, the only question I have on that story, George, is you might have, should have run DNA tests to make sure it was not Doyle who took that dump in the alley. Just saying. So a little bit earlier, we were talking about just growing up in the AG, and you grew up in AG churches. I forgot you went to Wheaton. That's awesome that the AG lets you stay in and go to Wheaton, but that's a whole other question.
Well, I went to Wheaton and Fuller, and I still got my credentials. That's
crazy. Wow. So growing up in the AG, was there anything, catch off guard, sorry, but was there anything that as a kid you thought was normal? Because like you went to AG church, you were around AG families. And then as you've looked back, you've thought, you know, that might not have been as normal as I thought it was. Can you think of anything that in your young years growing up that was like, yeah, for me, I mentioned it a while ago, like my wife and I met on opposing Bible quiz teams and we thought that was normal. And now we found out that's not normal for 15-year-olds to do that thing. But that's what we did. Is there anything you can think of, George, that you're like, you looked back and went, shh, that might not have been normal?
Yeah, I went through all Royal Rangers, Bible quiz. I'm trying to think of all that stuff. You know, what was interesting is, to me, you know, Dad was the pastor of the church where I was formed, right? He was the pastor of that church until I graduated from high school, essentially. And, you know, Greg, you mentioned that you started Seacoast as a non-denominational church. Well, Newport Mesa Christian Center, which is the church where my dad pastored, was an AG church, still is an AG church. But Dad always advertised it under Assemblies of God and under non-denominational. And we had people who were looking for an AG church. We had people who were charismatic Catholics. In fact, when I was a kid, we had so many people who were coming in from the charismatic Catholic community and also kind of Messianic Jews and whatnot, that I proposed to my dad that we had, because I always liked sitting in the balcony because that was the best spot in the house, right? I said, we should call the balcony the KG balcony. KG balcony. I said, yeah, let's put all the Catholics and Jews in the best seats in the house, right? So I grew up in a charismatic church that had a ton of professors from Vanguard University, a good diversity of Southern California people. And I never felt like we were weird, which sometimes, you know, you can go to Pentecostal charismatic churches and you walk into another church and you're like, oh, this church doesn't have flag wavers and people who bring their own tambourines or whatnot. That's not the kind of church I grew up with. So I had what I consider to be a very normal, you know, background. The kinds of especially Pentecostal type stuff that we grew up with speaking in tongues or prophecy or whatnot, there were some very powerful experiences. And in the 80s, I think that those were probably in the 70s and 80s during the Catholic, you know, charismatic Catholic renewal and the Jesus People movement. I don't think that those were considered as weird. It's hard sometimes looking back, you know, on my church and my experience growing up AG and saying it put me really outside of the mainstream because I was always involved with non-AG people. Public schools, even the private school I went to wasn't, you know, a denominational school. And so I just felt my life was very, very normal. I don't know. I was trying to think, I mean, we had women preachers, you know, women board members. I mean, I'm trying to think of the things that sometimes set that we look back on now and go, oh, that's so weird and abusive. But I mean, yeah, I had what I considered to be and still consider to be a very normal, ideal childhood.
Yeah, we did too. Like, well, let's just say we grew up in a different AG church than you grew up in.
George, you guys were compromisers. Come on.
Well,
you were.
Yeah. Sometimes people thought Dad was liberal, which was funny because in California, you know, I found that coming from California, everybody thinks in the Midwest or especially in the South that I'm liberal, which is weird because in California, I'm an arch conservative, and it's
liberals. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of it has to do with your geography and your background and how you define terms.
Well, that kind of leads into our last segment we want to do with you, George, and this is a surprise. I'm popping it on you. We may keep this as a segment on the podcast. It all depends on how well you do with it, but we're going to finish up with a quiz here. And hearing you talk about growing up and you got the Pentecostal evangelist not there anymore. We're not sure you're really Assemblies of God. Like, we're not sure that you are. So we've got a quiz for you, and just three questions, all multiple choice. And we'll see if you truly are Assemblies of God. Okay. First question. Every 2 years, General Council, every 2 years, the Assemblies of God has their national meeting. They call it the General Council of the Assemblies of God. We're familiar with it because that's the only vacations we ever took was because the church.
That would be the thing that was unusual. That was the only traveling vacations we ever took for General Council.
Us too. I learned to swim at General Council. Many things I learned we won't go into at General Council. So here's your question. Which of these cities have never hosted a General Council? Anaheim, California, Las Vegas, Nevada, Orlando, Florida.
Las Vegas.
Wouldn't that be awesome? An Assemblies of God General Council Las Vegas. Like 15,000 people not drinking, not gambling, not going to shows. It would be
evangelizing after every meeting. I mean,
up and down the strip.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you're right. I just guessed that one. I just assumed that they never, I put research into the other ones. I didn't research that one. Okay.
Number two. My dad was elected in Orlando and then retired in Anaheim. So I know that those are two general councils. And now we almost always go to Orlando. So
yeah, I know it's kind of stuck in Orlando now. So I knew that was safe. We went to Denver. We went to Kansas City. We went to Miami. Greg, you guys, you were in Teen Talent in Miami. Is that right?
Yeah. They call it, what do they call it now?
National Fine Arts.
Fine Arts. Yeah. We were Fine in Arts Miami. What I've never understood about the AG is why they pick the hottest places in America in the summer to do their deal. I've never understood that.
But think of the evangelistic pitch. You know, if you think it's hot here now, you know, I mean, you just kind of lead directly into a gospel conversation. So
I was going to throw in. I've worked for the Southern Baptist over the last few years, and they do one every year, and it's always in the hottest place, like Phoenix, Dallas. And I finally asked, why don't we go to places that are not, you know, 100 degrees or more? They said it's because it's the cheapest. Who else is going to do a conference in Phoenix in the middle of June?
That's true. All right.
Yeah. So Orlando definitely is cost effective, but it's also, you know, for all the pastors, including bivocational pastors who, you know, need to bring their family with them. It's a great way to get a family vacation along the way too. So.
Yeah. Well, so is Vegas. I'm just putting it out there for you. Number two. which of these cousins, we talked a lot about cousins today, which of these cousins attended Nelson University, also known as Southwestern Assembly of God University, my alma mater, also known as the Southwestern Bible Institute. So which of these cousins attended Nelson University? Jerry Lee Lewis, B. Mickey Gilley, or C. Jimmy Swaggart? Oh, this is a tough one.
I know this one.
I don't think Mickey Gilley went to Southwestern. I think that Jerry Lee Lewis was there for a time. I know that his grandson has a degree from Nelson, but I'm guessing Mickey Gilley didn't go.
Who you got? A, B, or C? Jerry Lee Lewis, Mickey Gilley, or Jimmy Swaggart? One of them went.
Oh, one of them went. Oh, I would say Jerry Lee Lewis.
Greg, is that right?
Yeah. We share some history there at Southwestern.
You were both invited not to come back. Isn't that correct?
We were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a better piano player. All right. All right. You're two for two. Last one. You brought up the Royal Rangers. So here's your question. Which of these is not part of the Ranger Code? I'm sorry, which of these is not a part of the Royal Ranger Code? A, clean. B, courteous. C, cool.
Look, the motto is ready to work, play, serve, obey, worship, live, etc. So that's a trick question. None of those are part of the code.
George, are we going to have to take away your little?
Am I confusing the motto with the code? Because it would not be cool, but the other two maybe. So I would have to say C is not part of the Royal Ranger Code.
Well, you saved yourself. I thought we were going to have to take the insignia off the eight points of the code, clean, courteous, and no, you could not wear that shirt and be cool. So it was not in the code. Very good. Very good. You really are AG. You got all three correct. You win our prize, which is the opportunity to be on our podcast. So congratulations on that. George, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And thanks for having me on. All right.
I want to talk about one of our sponsors, and that's Intentional Reach. And they could be your partner in turning audio and video sermons into top-notch transcripts. And they specialize in sermon transcription, podcasts, conferences, interviews, webinars. If it's spoken, they transcribe it. And these transcripts can boost your online reach up to threefold. Search engines love text, and transcripts make your content more searchable. Plus, at about $400 a month, it's a cost-effective way to expand your audience. And they're not just for websites. They can be repurposed for newsletters, blogs, social media, and more. So check it out. Go to intentionalreach.com and hit get your transcripts today.
Wow, that was fun. Kind of a little bit of trivia, a little bit of walk down memory lane. Greg, did you know the answers to all of those very difficult questions that we asked?
I knew them all. I just wanted to hold back a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Chris, how about you? Were you on top of all of those?
I actually knew the first and third one. I did not know the Jerry Lee Lewis. I'm not
did quite not that know. Old. No. Yeah, Jerry Lee Lewis grew up in the Assemblies of God. I was looking today just to make sure Elvis Presley at one point was part of an Assembly of God church. So, yeah, this has been fun on National Sibling Day. You're really in the top three of my favorite siblings that I have ever had. And so it's been exciting to spend a little of National Siblings Day with you. Be sure to check the links in the show notes. As we mentioned, we'll have a link in there to that video of the South Carolina coach, also a link to the website for the retreat. We'll also have in there ways that you could connect with the three of us. We'd love for you to like and follow the podcast. Helps other people find us. And one last thing. Hey, we have a newsletter that we talk about a lot of other stuff in. And so you can find out more about that in the show notes as well. Thanks for being with us. And we'll talk to you soon.